From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
This is a Bletchley Park podcast extra. MC Fontaine here. I'm sat with Catherine Lynch, presenter of the Bletchley Park podcast.
It's Christmas.
It's Christmas. So we thought we'd just put a quick little extra out just to say thank you to all our listeners. To look back over a fantastic year.
It's Christmas.
It's Christmas. So, Catherine, you got together with Ian Standen, the CEO, didn't you?
I wanted to get his thoughts on his first year in post at Bletchley Park. It's been a bit of a baptism of fire for him, but exciting times at the Bletchley Park Trust. So it's been a great year at the Bletchley Park Trust. We've had royal visits, VIPs, permission to start the HLF project. What else are you looking back on this year?
Well, firstly, yet another increase in visitor numbers. Looks like by the end of this year we'll be about 165,000 visitors, which is about 25,000 up on last year, which is fantastic, particularly given the current economic climate. And as you say, been a year of lots of visits from famous people. Prince Andrew came and visited us in March and had a very quick, fleeting look around the site. William Hague visiting a couple of months ago to come and announce the donation of £500,000 by the Foreign Office to allow us to close off and start our HLF-funded project.
And the future is bright as we go forward. We're now not just looking at 2013, but of course the next 10 years.
Indeed. When I arrived in post at the start of the year, John Scott, our Chairman of Trustees, said we needed a 10-year plan, and that's what we've been developing. So the first phase of that will be the delivery of our HLF-funded project by D-Day in 2014, so the 6th of June 2014, the 70th anniversary of D-Day. And then beyond that, we start to look at the rest of the site, which will be an 8 to 10 year plan. There's a lot of work to be done still. Probably require us to go back through another Heritage Lottery funded project, which will probably be bigger than the current one. So quite a lot of work to be done, but an exciting place to be in that we have got a 10 year vision of where we want to be.
And the combined might of Prince Andrew, senior member of the royal family, and William Hague, you know, senior member of the government, didn't quite pack the pouch that a dead pigeon did in terms of attracting attention.
No, it's been one of those quirky things about Bletchley Park is that the strangest stories seem to catch the attention. But as always, no publicity is bad publicity, and anything that gets our name out there is all good. Of course, you had to add to the pigeon things like the Bletchley Circle, a great little TV programme, again, got us some more exposure. MasterChef, again, got us on television to a different audience. And we've got a number of other television programmes in production at the moment, which will keep us out there in various different guises over the next 6 months to a year.
Not saying too much, but, you know, look out for Brian Cox and Victoria Wood, perhaps.
Brian Cox, indeed, and Victoria Wood, Escape to the Country, and who knows
yeah,
what else.
Yeah, who knows? Well, Merry Christmas.
And to you.
With 2012 being the Alan Turing centenary, it's made it an especially busy year at Bletchley Park. So what better time to create the Bletchley Park podcast? The idea of the podcast came to me after a conversation with Mark Rock, the founder of Audioboo, who kindly donated the channel which we host the podcast on. Around the same time, Catherine, our presenter, left the BBC and came to work for Bletchley Park as our media manager. So I've put together what I think are some of the highlights of the last 6 months.
Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast.
Welcome to Outriders, travelling somewhere in the space between technology and culture. This week, the home of our World War II code-breaking heroes, Bletchley Park, is podcasting. Now, on Outriders, we do like to point your ears towards interesting new podcasts. And this week, we were alerted to the Bletchley Park podcast, produced in Bletchley Park, home of Britain's World War II codebreakers.
This is Bletchley Park calling. This is Bletchley Park calling. Please be aware, we will be broadcasting from this station shortly. Bletchley Park, over and out. Bletchley Park. Over and out.
You're listening to BBC Three Counties Radio.
Bletchley Park is launching its first ever podcast. It will feature stories told by the Codebreakers staff and volunteers, audio from events and lectures, fascinating facts and artefacts which are still emerging, and reports on the progress of the development of Bletchley Park. First edition is being released today, and to tell us more, well, she used to work for the BBC, but she's defected and she now works for Bletchley Park. Catherine Lynch, good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us about the aim of the podcast.
Well, Bletchley Park is no longer Britain's best kept secret. I mean, Winston Churchill described the Codebreakers as the geese who laid the golden egg but never ever cackled.
Yes.
Well, now we're cackling. We're wanting to tell people. We want to spread the word about what's happening at Bletchley Park. There's a huge appetite for information about what's happening at Bletchley Park. It's a very fast developing, fast growing museum. People are fascinated to learn about the story of the Codebreakers, and quite rightly.
We're in C Block here, which was the Cardin next year in the Second World War. It was used after the war and has been empty for, must be 25 years or more now. And this is going to be our new visitor centre reception for the site of Bletchley Park. And as you can see from the state of the building, it's looking a bit tired. The walls are peeling, the roof's falling in, and the floor underneath our feet is pretty damp and squelchy.
A happy home to quite a number of pigeons at the moment, though, isn't it?
Indeed, yes. You don't get dive bombed while you're working in here.
It was then the government said, get the children out. And I remember the morning of the evacuation was just like any other morning. There wasn't anything to say what was going to happen. And I remember we got up and we had our breakfast. And I started to put on my coat. My mother looked at me. She said, don't put that coat on, put your best coat on. And I said, it's not Sunday. She said, just do as you're told. So off went my school coat on, wear my best coat. I put on my gas mask. Then Mum came over to us and she started to tie a label onto the gas mask. Something was going on. We went along to a mainline station. There were thousands and thousands of children there being looked after by the Red Cross and the WVS. From that moment on there, our parents weren't allowed to walk with us. I held my brother's hand and we kept being chivvied along by the Red Cross. And as I went onto the platform, I heard a crash. And when I turned around to look, they pulled the barrier across. So we're one side of the barrier and my parents are the other. And that was the last I remember, being put into the carriage, the door slammed and the train pulled away. And at the age of 6 and a half, I thought my mum had carried out her threat. We'd been naughty and sent us away. And I thought, it doesn't matter, I'm going back tomorrow. But it was going to be 6 and a half years before we ever went home again.
Bletchley called me up about a year ago and said, have you heard of a chap called Alan Turing? I said, well, yes, actually I have, because I went to King's College, Cambridge, where Alan Turing also studied, and he was professor there as well. So I used to do my essays in the tiny computer room, which, of course, was the Turing room. And so I said to Bletchley, well, do you know a little bit about it? Why, what's the project? And they said, well, we've got this Monopoly board. And from that moment, we knew we had to do something with this and help Bletchley out. And here we are today.
I'm very, very pleased when from time to time I meet somebody whose name actually appears in this book and on our website. So welcome to Mrs. Ros Poland, who was Wren de Vasse. We believe you worked on the bombs, the code-breaking machines. She was one of hundreds of Wrens who worked on these very, very important machines, because what they did was, after the mathematicians had done all their fantastically clever work, they sped up the checking out of what they'd done and actually breaking the German Enigma codes. And later on, I believe you went out to Colombo in Sri Lanka, as it is now, and worked there. So later on, we're going to come and see you and interview you and find out exactly what you did and add it to our records. You will, I'm sure. So I'm very glad to give you not one, but two badges. First of all, this one gives you the freedom of Bletchley Park. So that's from us to you. And there's a certificate and all sorts of other bits and pieces you can take away with you later. And you get another badge, the official government badge, presented by GCHQ, or the Government Code and Cipher School, as they were originally. Finally, a certificate signed by somebody called David Cameron.
I do remember particularly the first V2 that landed on London, because I happened to be at Fighter Command headquarters by then. And we'd been told that there was a secret weapon. We didn't know anything about it. But some of the radar stations were fitted with some equipment that might give a clue. And if any radar plotter gave a message to the Filterham plotter that said the code word Big Ben, the first filterer had to get on a chair and shout out Big Ben three times. Guess who was the one who did the first one? On September the 8th, that was me.
The Germans never targeted Bletchley Park. They did not even know that it was an important place which might have become a target. What seems to have happened on the night of the 20th, 21st November is that a bomber, having a few small bombs left over, decided to unload them when he happened to be flying in this area. When I returned to Hut 4, my place of work, the following morning, I learnt that a bomb had fallen a few yards from the right-hand end of the hut. During my lunch hour, I went outside to have a look, and there, a few yards from the end of Hut 4, I saw a shallow crater beside a small hut, an unnumbered one. I never really knew what it was used for, but understood it was an overflow from the typing pool in the mansion. Not right up against the hut, but quite near it, and the small hut was leaning over slightly in the direction of the mansion, and it was generally thought, I understood, that a couple of men would probably be able to push it back upright. The mythic version of this story says that some wrens on night duty in the other end of Hut 4 felt the earth move. They may have done so.
This poem is called Veterans Day, and it was inspired by being at Bletchley Park when they had the Enigma reunion weekend. And this is for Bletchley Park veterans, their families, volunteers and staff. The house, broad-shouldered in more ways than one, warmed by the last of the September sun, welcomes back prodigal daughters and sons and their families. You'd pass them in the street without a glance, as if invisible, not give them chance to talk, fearing their minds lead some phantom dance. But back in the day, these were the brightest and best, the whip smart, tack sharp, lips locked and secrets of the heart dead bolted, even now schooled in the art of willful silence. The Enids and Alberts, Peggy's and Jacks, dwelled in the shadows of the OS Act. Ridley's shooting party made their impact and helped win the war. They have known more, seen more, served more, saved more than we ever will, and now in the still, heavy quiet, pregnant with memories of loss and longing, I share their burden, if not their secrets. No day is ever perfect with regrets, but I stand grateful to be in their debt outside the big house.
It was rather funny, really, because my father really hammered it into us. You must not talk about anything. Well, he met me at the gate, and I thought, what the devil does he want? And he said, oh, some people want to talk to you. So we went into the mansion. We went up to the first floor, and he pushed me into this room and said, there's some people want to talk to you. I'll wait out here. No explanation. And I went in, and I was confronted by a long table going from side to side, covered in a grey army blanket. Seated at the table, there were three very high-ranking officers, one from each of the services. In front of each man was a brand-new, unused notepad and a pencil and his service cap. And it amused me faintly because every peak of the service caps were pointing in the same direction, all very military. And the man in the middle was army, I think he was a colonel, and he set off by saying, you know, name and it, all that stuff. And then he said, when you're at school, do the other children ask you what's going on here? I said, yes, all the time. And they all leaned forward rather anxiously and said, and what do you say? So I said, well, it's just a lot of civil servants from London. Because that's what my father said, you know, you mustn't say anything else. So that seemed to satisfy them. And then he said, are you ever approached by grown-ups or on the train or in the town? I said, no. And that was it. And then he made a great long speech about how important Bletchley Park was and that it was absolutely vital that nothing should be discussed or given away at all. And he really hammered this point home. And then he fished into his briefcase and put out a document in front of me and said rather solemnly, this is the Official Secrets Act. I could see that because it was on the top. And he said, it's a solemn pledge, a solemn promise, because this place has got to be kept very secret. And he went on and on. And then he handed me a very, very posh fountain pen. And he said, you must write your name in capitals there and then sign it and date it. So I did that. And he said, thank you for coming. And I went to join my father. And as I went out, I heard someone chuckle. And I was a prickly little devil, actually. And I said, they're laughing at me. He said, no, they aren't. He said, they're laughing because you're the youngest ever to sign the OSA. When I was 13. And, you know, they needn't have bothered. It was obviously very, very heavily stage-managed to impress a schoolgirl. But, as I said, I'd had it dinned into me, my father, so they were, you know, it was really a bit of a rain dance.
World War II was about freedom. It was about maintaining our freedom and not being ruled by others in a way that we didn't want to be ruled, and to maintain freedom of speech and freedom of action, and to be able to do what we wanted in our lives. And from that war, famous names came out of it, which we all know. Churchill, Eisenhower, Patton, Montgomery, these roll off your tongue. The one that doesn't roll off everybody's tongue is Turing. And if you think the purpose of the war was to fight for freedom, then if this one man and the team that, of course, was with him shortened the war by some 2 years, they say, and with all the lives that that saved, but also raises the question is that if Turing and his team didn't exist, could we have won the war? And I think the answer, as an army man, was no. I don't think we would have. We were struggling anyway, as we all know. So this one person helped more to maintain freedom and secure it than any one person that I know of in British history.
People find it hard, don't they, to understand in today's information age, and they find it difficult to grasp the natural secrecy.
Yes, I discovered that when I was quite young because of the silver tankard. The silver tankard arrived after war was over. Those words on it, you know, to MHAN from the Newmanry. I'd never heard of the Newmanry. And so, of course, I asked, well, what's the Newmanry? And my mother eventually took me aside and said, it was to do with codes, but you must never tell anybody. And so, of course, I didn't.
The whole secrecy thing was, I think you're right, it was completely in people's DNA. But one of the things that I think is quite interesting is that people did know that Bletchley Park was where codes were being broken. They knew it during the war. So everybody knew that people were working at Bletchley Park. And frankly, it didn't take a great deal of intellectual leap to work out that if you put a certain collection of people together that that must have been the kind of business that they were engaged on. But how and what the results were was not known until the mid-70s. And that's an astonishing story in its own right.
What are your memories of when it started to come out in the 70s, William?
I knew a little bit, as I've said, about it. And I was rather pleased because it was just nice to know that he did something worthwhile.
Did he ever talk about it, or did he sort of remain fairly tight-lipped?
I would say fairly tight-lipped, but he could think of a few things that he felt he knew were innocuous, like the machine that they had at Bletchley that they used to show to important visitors, which had lots of flashing lights on it, and they would always take them to see this machine because it was, you know, sort of fancy. But in fact, I don't think it was a very important machine. I think it may have been the Tunny machine, the machine that simulated the tunny. That sort of thing he could tell us about.
Barry, 2012, how's the year been?
Absolutely amazing. 5 years back, we thought it was going to be big. We thought it was going to be something remarkable. But what's actually happened has been beyond anything that we'd really expected. I think Bletchley Park has been wonderful, and it's worked together very nicely. And I think people at Bletchley Park have been part of making it work, that there's a kind of synergy between Turing and Bletchley Park. I think it's clear that something special has happened during the centenary, and things have changed in a sense. Things have been taken to a new level. There's more awareness now of gay issues and equality issues. There's some awareness of autistic spectrum people and the way in which they contribute to science. I think that now geekish kids, many of them know that there is this fantastic person, Turing, that achieved so much in a short space of time and, you know, was maybe like them in lots of ways, you know. I think a number of people from different directions find Turing valuable to them in their lives. I mean, for the scientists, it's just that he did anticipate so many profound issues that are still with us and point to kind of ways of approaching very difficult problems. And so many scientists are really kind of struck by what Turing has left us. But then, you know, at the social level, you know, the kids who are, you know, gay or have Asperger's syndrome or just plain geekish or just maybe just are individual, you know, think outside the box a bit. I think Turing has meant a lot to a lot of people. It's very important that Turing's life and work is known generally, because I think he wouldn't be such a good scientist if it wasn't for the kind of synergy of the personal and the fine brain. I think people become important and innovative for very kind of complex reasons. The Turing year, I'm going to miss it when it's gone. The legacy is going to continue for many years to come, hopefully.
Turing was tallish, 5'10", and he was broadly built. He looked strong and fit. You might have mistaken his age, as he always seemed younger than he was. He was good-looking, but strange. If you came across him at a party, you would notice him all right. In fact, you might turn round and say, "Who on earth is that?" It wasn't just his shabby clothes or dirty fingernails, it was the whole package. Part of it was the unusual noise he made. This has often been described as a stammer, but it wasn't. It was his way of preventing people from interrupting him while he thought out what he was trying to say. Ah, 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 ah. He did it loudly. If you crossed the room to talk to him, you'd probably find him gauche and rather reserved. He was decidedly la-di-da, but the reserve wasn't standoffishness. He was a man of few words, shy. Polite small talk didn't come easily to him. He might, if you were lucky enough, smile engagingly, his blue eyes twinkling, and come out with something quirky that would make you laugh. If conversation developed, you'd probably find him vivid and funny. He might ask you, in his rather high-pitched voice, whether you think a computer could ever enjoy strawberries and cream, or whether a computer could make you fall in love with it. Or he might ask you if you can say why a face is reversed left to right in a mirror, but not top to bottom. Once you got to know him, Turing was fun. Cheerful, lively, stimulating, comic, brimming with boyish enthusiasm. His raucous, crow-like laugh pealed out boisterously. But he was also a loner. Jerry Roberts said Turing was always by himself. He didn't seem to talk to people a lot, although with his own circle he was sociable enough. Like everyone else, Turing craved affection and company, but he never seemed to quite fit in anywhere. He was bothered by his own social strangeness, although, like his hair, it was a force of nature he could do little about. Turing was the sort of man who, usually unintentionally, ruffled people's feathers, especially pompous people, people in authority, and scientific posers. Beneath the cranky, craggy, irreverent exterior, there was an unworldly innocence, though, as well as sensitivity and modesty. Turing died at the age of only 41. His ideas lived on, however, and at the turn of the millennium, Time magazine listed him among the 20th century's 100 greatest minds. Turing's achievements during his short life were legion. best known as the man who broke some of Germany's most secret codes during the war of 1939 to 1945, Turing was also the father of the modern computer. Today, all who click, tap, or touch to open are familiar with the impact of his ideas. To Turing, we owe the brilliant innovation of storing applications and all the other programs necessary for computers to do our bidding inside the computer's memory, ready to be opened when we wish. We take for granted that we use the same slab of hardware to shop, manage our finances, type our memoirs, play our favourite music and videos, and send instant messages across the street or around the world. Like many great ideas, this one now seems as obvious as the wheel and the arch. But with this single invention, the stored program universal computer, Turing changed the way we live. Today, personal computer sales hover around the million a day mark. In less than four decades, Turing's ideas transported us from an era where the word computer was the term for a human clerk who did the sums in the back office of an insurance company or science lab, into a world where many young people have never known life without the internet.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It is truly an honour to be here at Bletchley Park, and I'm very grateful to Sir John Scarlett, the trustees and Bletchley staff, to the many volunteers who've given their time here over the years, and to Ian Lobben and all our guests today. But I'm most grateful of all, actually, to the Bletchley Park veterans who have joined us today. I've just had an inspirational tour of some of the huts and blocks that you worked in the 1940s. And I'm not going to forget being guided through the workings of the bomb machines by two of your colleagues. I believe I speak for many of us working in government and politics today when I say that we strive to live up to and build on your generation's achievements on behalf of our country.
I used to see Turing from time to time, and I have a strong mental image of him walking along the corridor in one of the huts with his gaze turned downwards. He was a shy and diffident man, flicking the walls with his fingers, dressed in a mid-dark brown sports jacket and baggy grey trousers. This is not your Achilles figure. He was not a warrior king, but at that juncture, he was the most influential man in Europe, bar none. In a way, bar Churchill. And we owe this to Turing.
Don't forget to vote for us in the European Podcast Awards. The web address you need to go to is european-podcast-award.eu. Vote for the Bletchley Park podcast, please. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. MC Fontaine here.
Shut up.
I might put this in the end.
Enough cheese for you?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so...